and welcome to The Writer's Way, a Right Attitude radio show. This program is brought to you by the Office of the Quality Enhancement Plan. The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative that enhances student learning by fostering positive attitudes toward writing. I'm your host, Sierra Walton. Today, we will feature two internationally known scholars who study and write about different cultures, and who each talk about the development of cultural literacy as an essential component of education in today's global community. The first part of our show will include an interview with Dr. Ali Asani, who discusses the importance of cultural and religious literacy as a means toward honoring diversity and fostering coexistence. The latter part of today's show features an interview with Dr. Antonio D. Tillis, who talks about his work studying and writing about Afro-Hispanic literature and the value of foreign language study and engagement with different cultures. Both scholars visited Savannah State in 2015 to give talks and meet with students as part of a free lecture series sponsored by the QEP. To start our show today, we'll play an interview with Dr. Ali Asani that was recorded during his visit to campus in April 2015. Dr. Asani is professor of Indo-Muslim religion and cultures and the director of Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Islamic Studies Program at Harvard University. He has been a leading voice in efforts to demystify Islam in the West by promoting increased understanding through cultural literacy. To accomplish this, he has conducted workshops, worked with teachers in high schools and colleges around the world, and published several books and articles. He has been awarded the Harvard Foundation Medal for his efforts toward the improvement of intercultural understanding and race relations. Now let us listen to the first part of his interview, in which he details the historical context behind Western stereotyping of Muslims and explains how different interpretations of the Quran have helped shape modern Islam in South Asia. The interview was conducted by Dr. Lisa Yant, the QEP Director and Associate Professor of Philosophy.
Well, we would like, through the Right Attitude Program and on behalf of the QEP office, I'm Dr. Yant, we'd like to welcome our esteemed guest today. Dr. Ali Asani is Professor of Indo-Muslim and Islamic Religion and Cultures and the Director of the Islamic Studies Program at Harvard University. He also serves on the faculty of the Departments of South Asian Studies and African and African American Studies. A specialist of Islam in South Asia, Professor Asani's research focuses on Shia and Sufi devotional traditions in the region. In addition, he studies popular or folk forms of Muslim devotional life and Muslim communities in the West. And so we welcome you to Savannah State, Dr. Asani. Thank you for being here. So it's safe to say probably that you've dedicated a large part of your career to educating others about Islam. And so I was hoping maybe we could begin with a discussion of some of the historical issues that have contributed to stereotypical misunderstandings between Islamic communities in the West.
Mm-hmm. As you know, it's a very long history going back many, many centuries. I think some of it has to do with the geographic proximity of Europe and the Middle East, and that geographic proximity has often led to competition for resources, land specifically, but also economic resources, and as both European empires and Middle Eastern empires grew and shrank and so on, they inevitably came to clash. But what was, I think, a political and economically motivated clash in the sense of competition over resources came very quickly to be seen in religious terms. Mm-hmm. Because it's very easy to stereotype the other.
Right.
And so I think that's the very beginning that you start seeing the stereotyping taking place. What I think another factor that also seems to have contributed to this was, ironically, the fact that when the when the Prophet Muhammad started preaching about Islam in Arabia at the time, and then the teaching spread, he mentioned in a lot of this teaching, and you can see it in the Quran, he talks about Jesus, he talks about Moses, he talks about Abraham, he talks about all these different figures that Christians would have been, and Jews would have been very familiar with, but basically, you know, meaning the Christian majority. And there was a sense there that what is this new threat that's on the horizons, mm-hmm. that's actually appropriating our figures. Mm-hmm. And so there were all kinds of theories as to what this could be, because it's not denying, the message wasn't denying the validity of the teachings. And in fact just says that, well, this new teaching is just part of the old teaching. Mm-hmm. And so there were, you know, theories, conspiracy theories, like for example, some people said, well, this was the Antichrist, mm-hmm. and the way to mislead people. Mm-hmm. By appealing to the familiar and taking them. So in that sense, then there were these stereotypes developing. Well, Muhammad was a kind of a devil, mm-hmm. or antichrist. There were also some interesting theories about about Muhammad being in fact a bishop who, being thwarted of his plans of becoming pope, decided to found his own religion.
Oh, interesting.
So in that midst of I think the economic and the political, you start getting in a certain way eschatological meanings placed behind this. And of course this eventually leads to the formation eventually of the Crusades.
Right.
And I think the Crusades, and then on the Muslim side of things you have the Jihad, so you find religion is being appropriated,
right, as an
for imperial, yeah. for imperial goals on both sides.
Yeah.
And I think in that very tense kind of situation, especially when you have war thrives on the notion of the other, mm-hmm. who's totally opposite than you are.
Yeah, so. And the annihilation
that's
of
right.
the other.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Well, I think it is a really fascinating region, and to have such close proximity of the three religions found there.
Yeah,
you know, I think folks would be surprised to know about the various alliances and disalliances that have happened over time. You know,
sure,
in fact, there were periods where the Christians and the Muslims were in favor with one another against the Jews.
Sure,
and, you know, I mean,
it's
an interesting history, mm-hmm, in a very close proximity, entwining all of these different elements. Mm-hmm. So thank you for some of that background. I wanted to share a little bit from your 2002 American Scholar article on pluralism, intolerance, and the Quran, and to share your thesis there, and maybe to ask a question. There, and I quote, you argue that the Quran essentially espouses a pluralist worldview, one that promotes peace and harmony among nations and peoples. Through the centuries, however, it has been subjected to anti-pluralist or exclusivist interpretations in order to advance hegemonic goals, both political and religious. It is within the framework of this dichotomy between a pluralist Quran and an anti-pluralist interpretation that we can best understand the conflicting and contradictory uses of Quranic texts. So I was hoping maybe you could explain to our audience how exclusivist interpretations of the Quran emerged over time, and what consequences those hegemonic doctrines have had in the world in both Muslim and non-Muslim communities.
I'd be happy to. So before I start, I should actually mention that while this particular article talks just about the Quran, mm-hmm. I think the arguments that I'm making there can actually be applied to any scripture.
Right.
Because I think scriptures as religious texts don't speak for themselves. They come from, you know, their creations in ancient worlds, and over time they are interpreted and reinterpreted and reinterpreted by communities of believers. And very often these communities of believers are influenced in how they interpret the text by the lived realities of their lives. Mm-hmm. So in a certain way, people project their lived realities, which are of course immersed in political, economic, and social contexts, and they project those ideas onto the text itself.
Absolutely.
So I think the the idea that a scripture could be read, for example, both in pluralist and exclusivist ways, or a scripture can be used, for example, to support racism and then to fight against racism, mm-hmm. or to support slavery and fight against slavery. Those kinds of things you find across the board in religion, in the history of religion.
Absolutely.
That scriptures get instrumentalized,
right.
by people.
And the written word being what it is.
That's right.
Both through translation and yeah. different understandings of meaning, right, lend itself yeah. to those
to these,
useful,
to these, yeah.
you know, kind of purposive yeah. ways.
So you get, so I think, so my thesis is that in every religious scripture you find pluralist teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also find verses that could be interpreted in a very exclusivist way.
Right. And just thinking so. About that thesis in conjunction with Christianity in
sure.
our own country, right?
Yeah.
We've got slavery, gay marriage, you know, you mm-hmm. pick your political mm-hmm. issue mm-hmm. and you can see how the scripture has been used for or against certain arguments
yeah.
on those,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
Hot
so
issues.
I think that very often, so when I wrote that article, there was this perception that, well, the Quran is a text that promotes terrorism and violence and this is why you had 9/11 and this is what promoted this. And what I was trying to do was actually to say, wait a minute, scriptures are interpreted by people, and this particular scripture has been interpreted by some people in very exclusivist ways, but it's also been interpreted by people in very pluralist ways, and that encourages respect for difference. Why is it that we're not hearing the other side? So the purpose of writing was, one, to talk about, well, there is this pluralist side of reading the Quran, and number two, that if we want to talk about the exclusivist side, just as we would in any religious tradition, let's contextualize it so that the people who are reading the text exclusive in an exclusivist mode, very often to support political domination, either of non-Muslims or, in fact, Muslims who are different than themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Their motivations have to be then contextualized.
Right.
You know, to understand that these kinds of interpretations are heavily embedded in particular political and economic hegemonies.
Yeah, and you know, since the publication of that article in 2002, we've seen the rise of new groups, you know, like Boko Haram. The Taliban, of course, was active at that time, but that would be one example of a policing force that wanted to
sure,
have
yeah.
a certain exclusivist interpretation of a pure form of Islam than, you know, to
yeah.
met out punishment
yeah.
to those practicing in the wrong kind of way, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So if part of it is a problem of illiteracy or not knowing enough about mm-hmm. the religion that they're claiming, how does one educate against that?
Mm-hmm.
Is that possible? Whose role or responsibility is that? Is it the state's responsibility? Is it the scholars of Islam? Is it the Muslim community?
Yeah.
How do we
yeah.
even approach that kind of
well,
education?
I think that part of it, so this, you know, when you talk about literacy, there's two types of literacy, mm-hmm. religious. One is literacy about the history, the doctrines, the theology, and so on and so forth. And at that level, in many Muslim nations, the nation state itself has hegemonized the control of religious institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how the nation states emerged.
Because
there were new
perpetuation
there were new,
of the interpretation
yeah.
can.
And so what happens is, so you have the idea of the nation state is basically one that was, let's say, exported
mm-hmm.
through colonization
mm-hmm.
and so on, and these nation states were created by different European powers. And then in the post-colonial period, these nation states which are sort of artificially constructed.
Right. Strangely drawn boundaries.
Yeah. And they have diverse groups in there. Mm-hmm. And then you have elites that have inherited this nation state. Mm-hmm. And they try to control the nation state. And one of the institutions that they try to control are religious institutions. Mm-hmm. Because they see religious institutions as having a lot of power. And in the process, they also try to control religious education. Now what this has created is that very often, because there are many different interpretations of Islam, many different varieties, so if the state is going to control religious institutions and then also religious education, they tend not to teach about Islam in its diversities, but they tend to pick one interpretation of Islam that seems to fit their own ideology, mm-hmm. and then use that
as the one to
impose. So these are major issues, yeah. Right? Especially the state control of religious education, rather than leaving it to religious groups. I think traditional religious authorities, like the ulama and so on, have been marginalized by the nation state. Mm-hmm. And there are all kinds of new authorities that have emerged. The nation state is one, the media, mm-hmm. I would say both, initially the television, the radio, and now increasingly the internet mm-hmm. has developed as a new authority where mm-hmm. people are getting sources of information. And then you also have new intellectuals coming up, some coming from different types of training who are challenging the traditional authorities. And then you get people like Osama bin Laden or these people from the ISIS who have access to arms and ammunition, and then they claim, well, we have authority too. Mm-hmm. Why not? So it's become like this free-for-all, which makes this whole issue of religious education very complex, but it is a huge issue. I think the other issue connected with this, and I would say it's a global issue, it's not specific to Islam, how do you create literacy about the nature of religion and culture? Mm-hmm. Because I feel that in our world today, we are surrounded by cultural and religious difference, but we don't equip our students with the tools to engage with and learn from this difference. It's somehow understood that there's difference around you, you'll somehow learn. But I think that if you want to engage with diversity and difference, you have to be taught how to do that.
Right.
It doesn't come naturally. You know, the natural sort of response to diversity and difference is fear.
Right.
And to overcome that fear, education has play a very, very important role. And there I would say what's going on, that is a key need in Muslim societies, but I think globally as well. So this is where I think, for example, the American educational system, while America is the most religiously diverse country in the world today, mm-hmm. Also ethnically diverse, but I don't think we do enough to help our students engage with this diversity,
right.
And that creates problems in this country as well, because illiteracy about religion and culture will affect the nature of democracy. Because if you are afraid of your neighbors who are not like you, you start getting stereotypes, you start getting prejudice, and so on. And this idea of having a citizenry that respects each other. It's never going to materialize, because democracy is premised on the notion of an educated citizenry.
And an engaged citizenry.
That's right.
Right?
One
doesn't isolate itself, but mm-hmm. one that crosses the boundaries.
Welcome back to The Writer's Way. Before the break, you heard part one of our interview with Dr. Ali Asani, We will now play for you the second half of the interview, in which Dr. Asani talks about a lesson he learned from his father about pluralism and cultural understanding, and the spiritual and aesthetic power of writing. Upon listening, we hope you might be inspired to consider the important role that cultural literacy has to play in the pursuit of equality and social justice.
So, speaking of kind of cultural literacy and pluralistic education, I found the story from your childhood very interesting, where you shared about your first lesson from pluralism from your father. And so I was hoping maybe you could say a little bit about your own personal background, kind of your upbringing and the culture you found yourself in, and the question that you posed to your father and the way that he responded to you to give you your first lesson about pluralism.
So I was born and raised in Kenya in a family of South Asian ancestry. So my family's been in Kenya at least for about 200 years, at least on my mother's side. So we've been there a long time. You know, I'd never actually even been to the Indian subcontinent, so all I knew was Africa. Mm-hmm. That was my world. But I was living at a time in Kenya. I was in Kenya, but I was living at a time of colonialism. And under British rule, a society was highly segmented. So we lived in a situation of apartheid, where you had, the whites, and then you had Asians. They called people from India, and they just called Asian, which I found very surprising when I came here to find that Asian means something different here.
Yeah.
And then you had the Africans, and people had very different sort of educational systems, healthcare systems, what kind of jobs you could do. Access to higher education was based on this, and so on. So it was a society that was deeply divided on racial grounds. And then within these groups, there were subgroups. So I knew, like, within the Asian groups, there were different religious groups. There were Hindus and there were Muslims of different sects and different types of Hindus and Jains and Sikhs. And in this monolithic African group, there were so many tribes, spoke so many different languages, and then they also had so many different religions. And because the difference was played such an important role, like what kind of race you were, what kind of religion you were, played such an important role in society. I happened to just ask my father that, well, why did God create people different? Why did God create difference? And he quoted this verse from the Quran, which I'll just paraphrase. Which goes something like, we, meaning God, created you male and female and created you into nations and tribes so that you may know one another or you may learn from each other. It depends on how you translate it. But the idea is the same, that through difference we can actually learn more about each other. So in a certain way, the way I was explained to it was that difference in human society, both, I would say, gender difference, but also religious difference, ethnic difference, all kinds of difference, was actually part of the divine design, mm-hmm. and it was meant to for us to be an occasion of education
and learning and
exactly,
coming to knowledge. Yeah,
as opposed to people have generally used difference to build walls.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw this as, well, actually, the reason that God has created difference is for us to build bridges of understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of bridges of understanding, we're building walls.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then also, by building these walls, we are denying the humanity of people who are different than we are.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an idea that, of course, as a child, I thought, oh, that was good. But then as I grow older, and then you look at the world and being
just
in the profession.
The difficulty
yeah,
of that task,
yeah,
of
yeah,
understanding.
Then,
yeah.
And then as you're older and you see the world and you see some of these issues about religious and cultural illiteracy, and you think, wow, okay, there's a lot of truth in this.
Mm.
Even whether one accepts the Quran as a divine text or not, but the idea behind it is very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. You know, we brought you to campus to help on that mission of cultural literacy, to help, you know, our students and our community think more about the global world in which we live, and in particular with our program, the Right Attitude Program. You know, we want you to help our audience understand a little bit more about knowledge, pluralism, and writing, that connection to writing. And so I was hoping maybe you could speak a little bit about the two forms of knowledge that you're going to speak to the university-wide audience tomorrow about, and also the importance of the written word in the Islamic tradition.
Mm-hmm. So I think that there is the first type of knowledge, of course, as we've already talked about, mm-hmm. is that the knowledge that you acquire from encountering difference, that, you know, that difference is an occasion of knowledge. But you have to know how, you have to have the tools and the frameworks to encounter, to understand that knowledge. And in the Islamic tradition, the guidance on how to think about difference as a source of knowledge is very much based on scripture. And there is this notion of the book. Mm-hmm. And book, I would say, people tend to take it very literally, but I think this book is just a metaphor. And there is this idea that God has given knowledge to humanity through the book. And this book, sometimes it's seen as this heavenly prototypical text that gets revealed in different communities through different prophets. And that book is full of wisdom to guide people. And in the case of Islam, that book is the Quran, mm-hmm. and that it was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad. Now, the Quran itself talks a lot about the importance of knowledge and the pen. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you almost get this sense of the image of God as a scribe who's writing. Mm-hmm. You know, again, it's a metaphor, but it's very clearly connects the book, writing, as something connected with the other world. Mm-hmm. That writing, this kind of education and knowledge, again, using the book and the pen as a metaphor, is something itself that is divine. Mm. And that it is a divine gift. So just as diversity is a divine gift, here is another divine gift. This form of knowledge that is embodied in scripture that is supposed to guide you on how to think about the world. And so I think that this form of the scripture, so all the scriptures, the Quran, the Torah, mm-hmm. the New Testament, and so on, are all seen as earthly manifestations of the same heavenly prototype, but revealed to different prophets. And they all have the same message. They confirm and reaffirm each other. So that is an underlying sort of notion. And that resonates really well with this idea that God has actually created humanity very differently, mm-hmm. but from oneself. So in a certain way, the process of revelation in scripture, that it actually comes from one source, and also difference in creation, and I would even extend it to other species, actually also comes just from one source. Mm-hmm. So both forms of knowledge actually, I think, support each other and resonate each other, yeah. and help you to think about your role in the world, but also how to think about what kind of a worldview that you want to develop that comes to accept and respect difference.
And metaphorically then, writing is the way that these different religions can actually be united.
Sure, yeah.
I think it's interesting, you know, when you were talking about the importance of writing in the Islamic tradition and in many Muslim cultures, the art of beautiful writing actually becomes highly developed, and letters themselves are seen as aesthetically and meaningfully imbibed with a spiritual power. Could you say a little bit more about how that shows up, what that looks like?
Yeah. So the Quran itself, which, as I mentioned, is seen as part of God's revelation, as part of several scriptures, the Quran itself is approached by Muslims in many different ways. So people, of course, people see it as a physical book, something that you touch, you can open, you can read. But it originated actually as an oral scripture. Mm-hmm. So oral both in the sense of something that you listen to and something that you recited. So oral in both senses. Mm-hmm. So it was a text that was very much connected with the senses. So even when you started thinking about the written scripture, the idea was that because this was divine, it had to be written in the most beautiful manner possible, mm-hmm. which led to the development of calligraphy in the Arabic script as an important art form. And so you have these wonderfully illuminated and designed Quranic manuscripts where people painstakingly spend years, you know, writing up the letters and embellishing them and decorating them. Sometimes they're written in gold and so on. Amazing pieces of art, so that aesthetically they are pleasing. And this actually is an interesting aspect of this writing, because the idea is that aesthetics and beauty is another way of knowing. So the Quran, for example, can be recited, and as a recited text, sometimes the beauty of the recitation can be such that it helps you transcend, you know, forget yourself. And the same thing with the writing, that the writing itself can be so beautiful that you just delight in its aesthetics and how beautifully it is done. So that even people who don't know the Arabic script are sometimes very impressed with this. There's actually a story that during the time of the Crusades, some of the Crusaders, as they went into the Middle East and so on, they brought back wonderful tapestries and rugs with Arabic calligraphy on them. They just appreciated that art form. Mm-hmm. And some of these were then hung up in churches as part of the decor of churches. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, one of them, or several of them, containing the Muslim profession of faith, that there is no God but God and Muhammad, made their way into European churches. People didn't know what they said, but they looked so beautiful, they put them up. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of universality in this aesthetics. But beyond that, because the word itself that's been captured in the writing is seen as divine, the script itself has been given a divine kind of a meaning, so that it has power, it has spiritual power, something that's called baraka. And so people use the script, or for example, a phrase from the Quran can be put on a bracelet and it acts as an amulet, or it can be put on a pendant and you can wear it around your neck. So there's this sense that the script has a protective power that protects you against evil. Mm-hmm. So you start seeing the evolution of the script, not just as something to write the Quran, but it starts getting into all kinds of objects, everyday objects. It could be things like jewelry, it could be pendants, but it also starts making its way into things like pottery, like ceramics. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, undoubtedly you find them in mosques, you know, you find calligraphy as inscription in mosques, and there it's very aesthetically integrated with other design patterns, like with floral design or geometric design, and the script is integrated into the two. So while being a source of knowledge, it is also aesthetically an art form.
Right.
That is integrated into the other arts. So to me, this is very important, because when I, you know, when you talk about literacy, about the nature of religion and culture, you think about how do people learn, how do people know. And yes, you can know through intellectual discourse, but I think there are certain forms of knowledge that you acquire through just the aesthetics. You see a beautiful piece of art, you listen to a beautiful piece of music, and so on. And you are, it's a form of knowledge. Mm-hmm. You can't intellectualize about it, but you know that you know something, you've encountered
something.
And you've
been transformed.
And you've been transformed, because that's what knowledge is about.
Yeah.
And so that, for me, is a very, very powerful role that writing can play, or has played in not only Muslim societies and how they think about their traditions and the role of writing as a sacred text, but also can play a very important role in people who want to understand things about Islam, because sometimes you can communicate through the aesthetic and the artistic, mm-hmm. what you can't through the theological and the doctrinal.
Yeah. Great. As we close, I just was wondering if there's any parting thought or words of wisdom that you would like to share about pluralism, about Islam, you know, just a thought for our students as they are embarking on their cultural literacy education.
So first, I think the most important thing that I would like to stress is the need to be literate about the nature of religion and culture, because I think this is a pressing problem. Mm-hmm. We are growing in a world where we're seeing the consequences of people being religiously illiterate and culturally illiterate. And it's not just to do with Islam. We're seeing it even here in the United States, mm-hmm. That this is becoming a huge issue. We're living in a world that is increasingly polarized. And it's going to become dangerous. And I think we need to, just as citizens, press for better understanding between peoples and cultures, and respect between different peoples and cultures. And that respect and understanding can only come through knowledge. And so I would say that students or anyone who's watching the program should become an ambassador, pushing for understandings of different cultures, different races, different ethnicities, generally understanding human difference, but based on knowledge, because there's just far too much illiteracy and prejudice around.
Well, thank you again so much. It's been fantastic talking to you, and we really appreciate you coming and sharing your knowledge with us.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm Dr. Lisa Yaunt, the director of the Right Attitude Program at Savannah State University. Here's the writing tip of the day.
I am Sarah Dillard, a sophomore majoring in civil engineering and technology at Savannah State University. As a peer tutor at the SSU Writing Center, I bring you the Right Attitude writing tip of the day. There is more to research than Wikipedia. Savannah State offers many resources for student writers. Use the online databases, go to the library to visit the reference librarians, or set an appointment with the Writing Center to get help finding accurate and reliable resources.
The Right Attitude Writing Tip of the Day is brought to you by the SSU Writing Center and the Office of the Quality Enhancement Plan. The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative to enhance student learning by improving attitudes about writing. Visit the SSU Writing Center in Payne Hall to get assistance with your writing projects, and to learn more about how you can improve your writing attitudes and skills, visit qep.savannahstate.edu.
Welcome back, and thank you for tuning in. You're listening to The Writer's Way. Next on our show is an interview with Dr. Antonio Tillis, who is a professor of Hispanic Studies and the dean of the School of Languages, Cultures, and World Affairs at Charleston College. His scholarship focuses on Latin American and Afro-Hispanic literature and the African diaspora in Latin America. He is a widely published and accomplished scholar, has served on numerous editorial boards, and has taught and delivered lectures around the world. He has declared that his mission is to connect students to the world and the world to students, and in the following interview, he demonstrates this by providing insight into his talk, Writing the African Diaspora Experience. which he delivered to students at Savannah State in October 2015. Similar to Dr. Asani, Dr. Tillis stresses the importance of engaging other cultures through education and writing. Here now is his interview with Savannah State's own Dr. Camila Martin, Assistant Professor of African American Literature in the Department of English, Languages, and Cultures.
It is October 28th, 2015. I am Camila Martin, Assistant Professor of African American Literature in the Department of English, Language, and Cultures at Savannah State University. I am here with Dr. Antonio D. Tillis. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So Dr. please tell us who you are and a little bit about what you do.
Okay.